WMFO Medford 91.5 FM. It is The Big Picture. Derek Gary and Lisa Nichols with you until 9 o'clock tonight. 855-915-WMFO is the telephone number. That is 855-915-9636. Write those numbers down. Dial them into your phone. Call us. Harass us. Become a part of the show. We love talking to our listeners. 855-915-9636. Don't forget, you can find us all week online. Facebook.com/BigPictureWMFO. Coming up later tonight, Zika is in the news. The outbreak is happening in Florida, even as we speak. We'll tell you what's up with Zika, what's being done about Zika, and why all hope is lost. No, all hope is not lost. I didn't mean to say that out loud.
Just a little bit.
Lisa Nichols, the lovely and talented Lisa Nichols, here with me, as always. So we're taking a break from the summer of blood.
No mass killings.
No terrorism. Thank you. Since our last broadcast.
For 1 week. Yes. And we've been saying it every single week how, you know, normally in the summer we're kind of, you know, scratching around for stories and do a little few fluff pieces here and there. No days do we go without massive news stories.
No terrorism, no police have been murdered.
So this is probably one of our slowest weeks, but still there was a big news story every single day.
No mass shootings. So we're taking a break from the summer of blood.
Yeah.
So that we can lounge on the shimmering brown waters of Pooh Bay.
Right. I think the biggest story in the news today about a gun was that the fact that Apple has now changed their gun emoji to a water gun.
Oh, that's
because
nice.
We live in the world of unique little snowflakes and political correctness, as we say here on this show.
So join us, won't you, with the shimmery as we gaze at the shimmering brown waters of Pooh Bay, because today the Olympics began.
We are right on the heels.
Yes. It is day one of the Olympics. The opening ceremony doesn't happen until later in the week.
Mm-hmm.
But they started the soccer games today in front of a mostly empty stadium.
Right.
So.
That's so shocking.
So.
I believe the Algerian soccer team was stuck maybe in Atlanta because they didn't pay their bill for their flight.
That's a problem.
So they might be missing their game. That's how we're starting the Olympics this year.
Awesome. Well, there's always something like that that goes on. It never fails. So
have we made a bet yet on when the first person will be either shot or kidnapped? No.
No. You know what? I don't want to go there. I believe
it's going to be a magical experience for everyone.
Here's the thing. Tragedy at the Olympics is more or less inevitable. You're going to get some format of it. One way or another.
No, and absolutely. I mean, I only hope that the worst case scenario is like we had in Sochi, where, you know, a few of the swimmers couldn't get out of their hotel room because they had to kick down their bathroom door because they got stuck.
Yeah.
Luckily in Rio, we don't have many doors, so we're good standing so far.
We'll probably be talking more about the Olympics in Did You Hear coming up in just a little bit. In the meantime, Lisa, what's going on in our world?
Well, in local news, some of our smartest intuition still have not learned they need to pay. A majority of colleges in Boston for the fourth year in a row have failed to pay the city the full amounts it requested to help cover the cost of municipal services. Of the 19 colleges in the city that asked for payments, 14 paid less than what was requested in the fiscal year of 2016, which concluded at the end of June, according to data recently released by the city. None of the 8 colleges with the most valuable property holdings paid the full amount requested. Quote, "It's disappointing. I think these colleges are an asset and a benefit to the city, but they also have an impact on the neighborhoods around them," said City Councilor Josh Zakem. He went on to say, "This is not just extra money for the city. We need to operate the city. We're talking about our schools, affordable housing, police, fire, EMS, city streets, and public works." Under a 5-year-old program, the city asked nonprofits with more than $15 million worth of tax-exempt property in Boston to write checks to help offset the cost of police and fire protection, snow removal, and other services. The payments are voluntarily contributed in lieu of taxes, so meaning no taxes whatsoever for these schools. So for decades, Boston has been negotiating these payments individually with these nonprofits. It's actually interesting because this goes back to the days of Mayor Menino. And, you know, he introduced this concept of the pilot program. We talked about this last year. Again, schools weren't, and it was a great idea.
No, it wasn't a great idea. It was always a bad idea. Brian and I used to rail against this when he was here 5 years ago.
The idea of getting some sort of money from these schools.
Well, why shouldn't we be getting all of the money from these schools?
The way that it was implemented was bad. The fact that the pilot program, it is outdated. He essentially went to each of these institutions individually and said, "Hey, Derek, what can you representing BC pay?"
I think we're going...
But how is that okay?
Well, Boston College is going to get special treatment because they're a Catholic school. And there are very deep links between Boston College and the government, both in the city of Boston and the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and in the courts and every place else. It's full of BC grads. Nobody's going to make BC pay their fair share. They're all good.
But
the rest of these who are sitting on massive endowments
constantly every single year
seem to have the money to buy up every spare bit of real estate in town and turn it into more university buildings.
Well, there you go. That's the thing. Boston is now at 50% owned by nonprofits.
Right. Boston University owns a mile of Commonwealth Avenue. Northeastern University owns almost a mile of Huntington Avenue. You have Mass General spreading out all over the place. Emerson is taking over the block on the edge of the theater district. Suffolk is taking over anything that Emerson isn't trying to get their hands on.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned some of these schools, because I'm just going to give you some numbers. BU is actually the highest. They paid 80% of what is owed. Still, we're not at 100%. Yeah. Harvard, 56%. You mentioned Northeastern. How about 23%?
Yeah.
Emerson, that, yes, is expanding completely throughout the theater district, and they now have some off-satellite programs running in the seaport.
Yep.
Lowest at 16%.
Ridiculous.
BC,
ridiculous.
19%. Look. Emmanuel, 22%. Suffolk, 63%. Wentworth, 40%. These numbers, for the majority, are less than half of what is owed to the city.
We need to pass legislation here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts that basically says, we don't care that you're a nonprofit organization, you are a giant university, you are going to pay real estate taxes like everybody else. Make it a local option. What are these schools going to do? Move? Is Harvard University going to leave its location in Cambridge because all of a sudden we decide to get the tax money that we are rightfully owed for it? No. Is Boston University going to turn its back on $3 billion worth of development because we're asking them to pay an extra $40 million a year in taxes? No. Is Northeastern going to pull out of Huntington Avenue? No. Tax the damn schools. Tax the damn schools. Tax the damn schools.
No, absolutely. We're talking about these schools are the ones that are complaining about not having any snow removal every single
time
there's
taxes.
1 inch that falls in the city of Boston.
Pay your taxes.
Mm-hmm. Because who's paying for that? We are.
We are. Exactly.
I live in the city of Boston. I pay taxes to Boston. So all you schools that are getting multi-million dollar endowments, that are getting money funneled from alumni, that makes under $100,000 a year, I'm paying for you so your kids don't slip. And in fact, we're talking about schools, for the majority, their tuitions each year are $50,000 plus. I'm confused.
If you can afford... If you can afford $250 million to put up new campus buildings, you can afford to pay your taxes. And if that delays your campus buildings, oh well, boo-hoo.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Well, then if not, if you don't want to pay your taxes, then the percentage of what you don't pay should be free college.
No, I'm not even going there.
No, I'll go there.
No,
because you think they're going to all of a sudden give 2,000 students free? No.
No.
You're going to be paying for it.
No alternative. Pay your taxes.
But that at the minimum.
Pay your taxes.
I'm not giving an alternative. I'm saying...
No alternative. No free lunch. No passes. We tried the pilot program. The schools are taking advantage and screwing over the taxpayers in the city of Boston, which, by the way, is right.
Yeah, but they haven't been paying them for years.
Which, by the way, I know.
So what needs to happen?
I know.
Even if we pass legislation, what is going to happen?
Property taxes are going up in the city of Boston. Services are going down in the city of Boston. Why? Because every time you turn around in the city of Boston, there are more university buildings going up all over the place that do not pay their fair share in taxes. pay your taxes.
Well, that's the thing. If we look at real estate, and we've talked about it multiple times on this show, how much the city of Boston real estate property taxes and property values are continually going up. Well, if you look at Downtown Crossing, what, maybe 20 years ago, how many of the majority were privately owned businesses? They're all being bought out because these schools have the money to foot the bill for it.
And because nobody wants that real estate. So
now we're talking about the city of Boston. No, it's one of the theater district in Chinatown is the most expensive place to live in the city.
I'm talking about Downtown Crossing. Nobody wants that anymore because there were...
Have you been to Downtown Crossing lately?
Yes, I've been to Downtown Crossing lately. Nobody wants that area anymore because there were too many failed developments and it's sat idle.
Everybody is going into there now. I'm talking within the last year. With the new Millennium Tower, that was a big first one to do it. They redid the whole entire strip of theaters. Now you have a couple new hotels going in. High-rises, we're talking up in the... maybe like $1.5 to $2 million for a studio.
Yeah.
Penthouse upstairs. Yeah. It's very valuable, the theater district. But that's what's happening. We're talking about a city where these privately owned buildings are being bought out by schools. Now the percentage that is owned by these schools are going up.
It wasn't for several years, and that's why Emerson went in and bought everything.
It was awful years ago.
That's why Northeastern went in and bought everything.
That's why I'm saying to you, only within the past year. Of course, as I said, you have the Millennium Tower goes up, and everybody says, oh, hey, I guess it's cool to go in. All the rich people are going back in. We're fine.
But here's the thing. Kenmore Square was thriving for 15 years, because you get the Red Sox over there. Mm-hmm. BU is still buying everything that's over there. They're buying every spare building they can get their hands on.
Yeah, because it's one of... the lesser expensive neighborhoods now, and they can buy it.
I
mean, Kenmore is still up there.
Kenmore is pretty upscale these days. I don't know when the last time you were in the square itself was.
No, but if
and the area around it is ridiculous now.
At an updated map of prices for on average per square foot of property in Boston.
Well, it's cheaper than the Back Bay.
Cheaper than it's still going to be downtown. South Boston, Beacon Hill, but it's all these areas that were less desirable years before.
Yeah.
So now you have a city completely overinflated for what it's worth, essentially.
Mayor Walsh should be demanding a local rule that forces these schools to pay taxes. The Boston City Council should be demanding a local rule that forces these universities to pay taxes. Governor Baker should be demanding a state law that forces these universities to pay taxes. The Congress of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts should be demanding a law that forces these universities to pay taxes. If you own in excess of a certain number of square feet of building, you have to pay taxes because you are now a black hole of tax revenue in the city of Boston. You still get police, you still get fire, you still get snow removal.
And how much are we talking about that the city of Boston doesn't have any money?
You still get street sweeping.
There you go.
You still get the benefits of all of the infrastructure, all the highway crews, the MBTA, and all the rest of that, and you are not paying your fair share for it. Plus, these universities put a tremendous burden on our neighborhoods, particularly on police.
Mm-hmm.
So it is time for our friends up there on Beacon Hill to do something about this and demand that these universities pay their fair share. And when the universities come in and say, oh, we can't afford that or it's going to be the end of the world, look them in the eye and say, what are you going to do? Move. And when they say no, make them pay more. That's all. That's all. Make them pay their fair share.
No more of this nonprofit crap. I mean, that sounds absolutely amazing to me. But for it to be actually implemented and passed, I don't see it happening in the foreseeable future.
Because there is no political will to do it here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, which is why the voters...
You want to know where the money is missing? That's where it is.
Which is why the voters, especially you voters in the city of Boston, who are sitting around wondering why your taxes are going up and your services are going down, need to start electing people who are going to hold these universities accountable. They own some of the most valuable real estate in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, and they do not pay their fair share. Is that fair? Should you, as a taxpayer, be picking up an extra burden because Boston University and Harvard University and Northeastern and Suffolk and Emerson don't feel like paying taxes? There should be outrage.
There should be
people in the streets setting fire to university flags.
I'll have you know, Tufts pays 100%.
Of course they do.
So congratulations.
We sit here not on our high horse, but from a position of authority.
I like that.
In national news, the Obama administration is under fire tonight after the Wall Street Journal reported that $400 million was airlifted to Tehran at the same time that the Iranians released four American hostages in January of this year. According to officials in the United States and the World Court in The Hague, the money was part of a $1.7 billion settlement the United States owed Iran for a deposit on jet planes made by the Shah of Iran in 1979, shortly before the Iranian Revolution. Iran has painted the payment as a quid pro quo for the release of the four hostages, triggering outrage among Republicans, including Donald Trump, who accused Hillary Clinton of opening the cash for hostages talks while she was Secretary of State. Because the U.S. cannot directly pay Iran in dollars, pallets of Swiss francs, euros, and other currencies were secretly loaded onto a cargo plane and flown to Iran.
Wait, what's that word I'm looking for? Coincidence. What a coincidence.
Pallets full of cash.
Full of euros and...
You've been to the Home Depot?
Like golden blooms in there, yeah.
Maybe you go to BJ's. You know what a pallet looks like. Mm-hmm. It's piled high with stuff. It's got the plastic wrap all around it. Imagine that is cash being loaded onto a cargo plane and then flown coincidentally to Tehran.
Mm-hmm. On the same day, though, that they are releasing Americans.
Here's the thing. Whether this is a quid pro quo or not, it certainly looks like one.
Here's my thing, though. You know, this was reported extensively, and in the first one to report it was actually the Wall Street Journal. Now, in fact, the Wall Street Journal did report on it on January 21st that the money had already been wired. You can look up the articles. It clearly says it. So whether they made a mistake by writing that, but then this article that just came out yesterday, or actually today. This was today, saying, look at all this money. It just got wired over. Well,
we can't do that. That's illegal.
Just report it. I know, because we don't negotiate with terrorists.
No, because we're not under the sanctions against Iran. We're not allowed to conduct U.S. dollar transactions with them.
Yes.
So you couldn't just wire the money out of the Treasury, which is why they have to go fill up some pallets with Swiss francs. Mm-hmm. Put them on an airplane and fly them to Tehran in the middle of the night.
But from the Wall Street Journal, they're reporting that many people were briefed on the details of the situation. So, I mean, it was no secret. In other words, many people knew about it. It just isn't a good look at all.
It's not a good look. And what the White House maintains is that these are totally unrelated, separate events. That there was one group dealing with the situation in The Hague.
A completely separate group.
These are both connected to the nuclear treaty. So you got two different things. The United States wants their hostages. Iran wants their money back. Because in 1979, the Shah was going to buy some jets, mm-hmm. threw this money in a U.S. bank, and then when the revolution happened, we froze it. So not only are they getting their $400 million back, they're also getting $1.3 billion in interest.
And sanctions lift and multiple other things that go along with the Iran nuclear deal, which is one of the worst deals I've seen in a while.
$1.3 billion in interest. So Iran is making $1.3 billion mm-hmm. off of the revolution because they parked some money with the U.S. Not bad. I will take that rate of return. That's over about 40 years. I'll take that rate of return all day long. More than tripled their money. Even if these things are disconnected on the United States side, we know that on the Iranian side, there are two people making all of the decisions. One of them is the president of Iran. The other one is the Ayatollah. Mm-hmm. And the Ayatollah is telling the president what to do. So the Ayatollah, in his eyes, is sitting there saying, you're not getting your hostages until we get our money back. Whether they deposited the money or not, this is a cash for a hostages deal. That's what happened here.
It's black and white. If you have one side saying you're not getting this until we get our money, I mean, that's hostage situation 101.
It may be money.
But from their side, they're playing on the defense and saying, well, we're not going to get screwed in this situation where we release them. And then you decide that, oh, we're going to just break up the Iran nuclear deal and completely raise up these sanctions again, keep the $1.7 billion.
Yeah. Well, there's a problem with this $1.3 billion in interest and how that was negotiated. Okay.
Now, here's my question to you. We're going into the election in November. We have Hillary Clinton, who has maintained or backed this deal and then has kind of sidestepped and said, I don't really know. Then you have Trump on the other side, who is completely opposed to it. Come November, what do you think we will see with this deal? Are we going to have a situation where this is completely torn apart?
No, I don't think it's going to get undone. I think it's going to be left in place because, as I said at the time that it was announced, it's the best deal we're going to get right now.
At the time, yeah.
And it gets us a seat at the table, and it gets us talking to each other. Those aren't bad things, okay? It does give the Iranians freedom to kind of sneak around in back of everybody and try and make their nuclear weapons, but the global community is going to make that difficult for them.
No, absolutely. I mean, we're not completely leaving them on their own. There's something set up within the deal that U.S. militants are going in searching their caves or underground tunnels for these special nuclear
now,
plants.
Now, savor this moment while you can, because I am going to say that Hillary Clinton does not get any of the blame for this. This is not a Hillary Clinton issue.
Which I was surprised when Trump pulled that in. But of course, he's going to go against his opponent. But again, right. I don't think that she had anything to do with this.
Donald Trump is wrong to invoke Hillary Clinton in this. Yes, Hillary Clinton began the talks as Secretary of State with the Iranians. Hillary Clinton also left the State Department in 2012. All of this has happened since then. All of this happened on John Kerry's watch. So if you want somebody to blame, John Kerry's a convenient target.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly somebody in the White House knew that this was going on. And again, the White House can sit around all day and say this isn't a quid pro quo. It doesn't quite meet the definition of a ransom because it was money that already belonged to the Iranians. It was their money. So the Iranians are basically saying, give us our money back that you're holding hostage, and we'll give you your people back that we're holding hostage. That's not, because they originally wanted to do a prisoner swap.
It's not a ransom, of course.
It's not
but it's almost, it's a hostage trade.
It's not a ransom, but it is a quid pro quo, and it is money changing hands.
You have something that we want, and you have something that we want. I mean, it's...
It is money changing hands for the lives of Americans, and that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really bad look. That is not the kind of foreign policy that we want to practice in this country, because that encourages other countries to go and grab Americans. Now, maybe you've got Russia and North Korea and China and some other countries looking around saying, do we have any money in U.S.
Iran
banks?
Iran just got, $400 million.
Do we have any money in U.S. banks that they won't let us have?
Just airlifting.
How many Americans do we need to grab to get that back?
Mm-hmm.
Because getting the money back is almost as good as getting new money. Either way, you got money that you didn't have before. Of course, you lose out on the very lucrative interest payments that probably come with that.
And again, we're not talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. We're talking multi-million dollar, billion dollar deals.
Yeah. So did we per se pay ransom to the kidnappers? No, we did not. Did we do the equivalent of that? Yeah, we pretty much did.
Sort of, yeah.
We pretty much did. So welcome to America, where we now negotiate with terrorists and offer you cash payments in exchange for the safe return of our citizens.
Yeah.
Very, very...
Very 2016.
Very poorly done, is what I will say to that. In world news, in a nationally broadcast address, Turkey President Recep Tayyip Erdogan blasted the United States for failing to extradite self-exiled cleric Fethullah Gulen. Oh my God.
The worst.
This is the worst sentence I have ever written in my life. All right, let's take this again. It's radio. We can just edit this out, right? In a nationally broadcast address, Turkey President Recep Tayyip Erdogan blasted the United States for failing to extradite extradite self-exiled cleric Fethullah Gulen, who Erdogan has called the mastermind of last month's failed coup attempt. Before cheering Turkey Parliament, Erdogan said, quote, "This coup attempt has actors inside Turkey, but its script was written outside. Unfortunately, the West is supporting terrorism and stands by coup plotters," end quote. Erdogan also questioned the nature of Turkey's alliance with the United States. A recent poll by pro-government newspaper in Turkey found that 69% of people believe the CIA was not involved, found that 69% of people believe the CIA was involved in the coup, and 20% believe the White House was involved. So, basically, 7 of 10 Turks think the CIA did this. 2 of 10 Turks think the White House did it. This was,
I mean, there is also this narrative, though, that, you know, in the Turkish press, that the White House was slow to respond. So they're getting it from the press. They didn't respond with a statement. That's what they're saying. You know, basically, because the U.S. wanted to see who was going to win. That's the message that they were trying to provoke to people of Turkey. But really, what that shows is how little the Turkey press and media know about U.S. communications. Were we waiting to see what happened? No, it's just not initially getting involved or getting in a statement. And if we know anything about U.S. government, we take a long time to make a statement about anything. And that's homegrown. I mean, not even dealing with what's going on in Turkey. But this incident, I think, is really the latest indication of Washington underestimating the role of Turkey and how much Turkey disagrees with us and the relations, because we've been a lot involved lately with what's going on in Turkey. Now we have this going on where you have the president, you know, of the country saying, shame on you, Washington didn't put out a statement. We have, what, 69%, as you said, people in Turkey believe that the CIA was involved or Washington.
I don't know if you watched the speech or saw any of the highlights of the speech. This speech was, for those who are students of history, frightening, to put it mildly. This is President Erdogan in front of an entirely sympathetic parliament, going on at some length in an address broadcast on national television, demolishing the United States and demolishing the Western world, and questioning all of those alliances and questioning all of his relationships. Turkey is still trying to look good in front of the international business community, but make no mistake, there is now a very strong nationalist and perhaps fascist fervor rolling through Turkey, wildly supported by its people through this very, very popular president who seems to be drawing a line against the Western world. This is not a happy development. This is a dangerous development. And the reason you're not hearing anything come out of the White House, the reason you're not hearing anything come out of Europe about this, is because they don't know what to do. Erdogan has always been sort of a loose ally, someone that the international community thought was leaning more toward European integration than toward Turkish militarism?
Well, that's what I was going to say. We've been questioning so much about Turkey being entered into the EU and that kind of fine line that they've been playing and how far they would go, how vocal they will be, because they don't want to hurt their chances with getting in the EU with everything that's going on with terrorism. I think what just happened here is an indication of, you know what, we're done. We don't care about getting in the EU. Now, as you said, there's this nationalistic mentality from so many people in the country.
I think there's a certain amount of let's step back and not poke the bear happening in the international community. However, at the same time, I have to believe that the diplomats and the military analysts and the top-level analysts are looking at the situation in Turkey with a great deal of concern right now, as they should be. Because this is the second largest army in NATO. This is a country that could create a lot of problems if it were inclined to do so. Not just in the Middle East, but in Europe. And there's been some talk buzzing around about what Europe did to Turkey at the end of World War I and the end of the Ottoman Empire. When you see that level of nationalism combined with the level of nationalism that is flaring up in Italy, that is flaring up in Germany, that is flaring up in France, we have a very volatile and dangerous situation. I couldn't begin to tell you what's going to happen here. I can just tell you that what I see, what I saw in that speech reminded me of mid-20th century politics. And that is a giant red flag. Keep an eye on what goes on over there, because this could very well become the big story as we get further into this year, once we're done lounging on the brown shores of Pooh Bay at the Rio Olympics.
In sports news today, we learned balls will be flying in 2020. Baseball and softball will return to the Olympics for the 2020 Games in Tokyo as a part of a pack of five new sports, which include karate, skateboarding, sports climbing, and surfing. The five were proposed for inclusion last year by Tokyo organizers, and they were approved unanimously Wednesday by the IOC members. Under new IOC rules, local organizers can propose the inclusion of at least one additional sport for their games. Wednesday's approval was for the only Tokyo Games. The new sports will add 18 events and 474 athletes to the program. The Tokyo Games in 2020 will now feature 33 sports and about 110,000 athletes compared to the usual number of 11,000 athletes compared to the usual number of 28 sports and 10,500 athletes. As talks increase that baseball would likely return to the games, Major League Baseball players weren't completely supportive. Quote, I wore USA across my chest one time in college, and that was a great experience. It would be fun to do it again, but baseball season is very long the way it is. You play 162 games to add to another 2 weeks. I don't know if it would be the best decision for ourselves and our bodies. That was said by Chicago Cubs star Chris Bryant. Because Tokyo Olympics are running through July 24th to August 9th, MLB would have to interrupt its schedule, a 162-game and 183-day grind that has less flexibility unless owners and players' association are willing to cut games and lose revenue, which will never happen.
The season's too long. But look. Yeah. This is a non-problem. Either go with college athletes.
Exactly.
Okay. Like, or if you got to have the pros there, what are you going to be talking about? Like one guy from every team at most?
Of course.
There's only like 20 people on the roster.
No, it's the same thing like hockey. You have an option to opt out, but you have to look at the popularity of baseball and softball in other countries.
This is the thing. This is why Japan wants this.
World Series, of course. That's one of my dreams. I'm dying to go to Japan and see baseball there because how popular it is, and it's such a different experience. And everybody that says it, if you are a fan of baseball, you need to see it there.
I guarantee you that was a requirement of Japan hosting the Olympics. It's like
the only way
we get baseball. We get baseball and softball. We don't
care
what else you do.
How much money we lose. But think about
it. We get baseball and softball, or we're not doing it.
Money across the world that is spent between the two sports. I think this will be great for it. Surfing is another thing, because what you have to take into account, the fact that surfing is so different in so many areas of the world. It's, you know, surfing in Hawaii is completely different from surfing in Australia. That's why, again, I believe that we should have one specific venue for Summer Olympics, one country. You bring the host country. So everything stays the same.
So what happens if you have your Summer Olympics in Munich or Mexico City where there's no coastline, where there is no surf?
Well, then I guess that year they will not have it.
That more or less excludes surfing as an Olympics. I could see skateboarding being in there.
Oh, of course. Look at the popularity of the X Games.
Because there's a lot of athleticism that goes into that. But, you know, let's get some of the motorbike sports in here, too. I mean, I want to see guys, like, flipping and doing cool things on motorbikes. Let's get the vertical in there, at least. Baseball, look, you gotta suck it up and deal with it. The NHL, which makes less money and is more dependent on game revenues than I think Major League Baseball is, manages to shut down for a couple of weeks every 4 years so that they can all go play hockey, I think Major League Baseball can survive.
Well, no, and as you said, what, maybe a couple teams in each of the areas, so AL is going to have a few players gone. We're not talking about fitting a 50-man roster.
The problem that you're going to run into is, and this is the problem in the NHL, is even if the NHL said we're going to keep playing, all the best players in the world are in the National Hockey League.
Mm-hmm.
So all the Finns are leaving. All the Germans are leaving. All the Swedes are leaving. All the Canadians are leaving.
Oh, yeah, no, they're absolutely playing for their country.
What you're left
with, there isn't even a question.
What you're left with is a bunch of American bums skating around the ice picking fights with each
Minnesota
other.
Minnesota and...
Yeah, skating around the ice picking fights with each other and tending goal because all the power forwards are off playing the Olympics.
Because, you know, essentially that's what the Olympics is. You have an opportunity to represent your country in the sport that you excel in. And that's why so many people in the NHL, the players, leave to go do so. So it should be the same exact thing. We talk about how, you know, America or baseball is America's pastime and it's America's sport. You should be honored to represent it. And I get it. It is an incredibly demanding and grueling schedule that a lot of these players put up with. But we're also talking about a season where there are so many significant up and downs.
Yeah.
So the missing of one player isn't going to have that big of an impact on a team.
But here's the thing.
For a couple days.
It may be more than one player. You don't have to worry about the Cubans because they're not going to be allowed to play on their national team. But the Dominicans are going to leave.
Mm-hmm.
The Venezuelans are going to leave. The Mexicans and the Brazilians and the Taiwanese and the Chinese and the Japanese and everybody else you got from around the world coming to MLB now, they're all going to leave. So, you know, what do? Bring up some AAA guys. If you know all the superstar players are going to be out, bring up some AAA guys for a couple weeks. Keep playing your damn baseball. The AAA guys will be glad to have a shot. Their families will actually come to the stadium and watch them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it's like, oh, you're making your MLB debut. That's a big deal.
Oh, no, absolutely. If you know anybody that's in AAA and gets pulled up, they pretty much fly every single person that they've ever known from across the country into the city that they're playing in.
That's a huge deal. So, you know, either use college players or bring up the AAA guys.
What is it all about? It's all about the monies. And they believe that if the stars aren't there, not making the home runs, not making the amazing catches in the outfield, that people aren't going to want to go. MLB, it's maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks out of the whole entire season. I think we can deal with it.
We're talking about July, August.
Nobody wants to go to games anyways. Do you want to sit out in Fenway Park?
No, just the exact opposite. This is exactly the time of year when everybody goes because work schedules are a little bit lighter. People are on vacation.
Well,
like,
unless the Red Sox are in a slump, then nobody goes.
Yeah, but if the team stinks, nobody's going either way. Well, you know, it doesn't matter who's on the field or how many superstars you've got.
No, I feel like...
Look at the Yankees. They stink. Nobody wants to go to those games.
No.
A-Rod might be out on his butt before the end of the season.
No, if you look at a majority of tickets, it's in the beginning and the end of the season.
Yeah.
Well, that middle's kind of...
The beginning because you have hope, the end because you're in a playoff race.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that happens in the middle is sort of, hey, it's summer, let's go watch some baseball. Yeah, and you're going to get that crowd either way. It doesn't matter who you put on the field. Because the people who are going to stay home and watch the Olympics are going to stay home and watch the Olympics. And I will bet you anything, Major League Baseball attendance is going to be off for the next couple of weeks because everybody's watching to see what building is going to fall down next down in Rio. Whether or not the Velodrome can actually handle having some bicycles in it.
Well, in food news, we learned there is a reason to cry over spilled wine. An entire street, cellars of apartment blocks and underground car parks have been flooded with wine in a southern French town in a suspected act of sabotage by a shadowy group called the Wine Terrorists. Thousands of liters of the tipple poured out of 5 giant vats in a wine merchant late Tuesday evening in the Mediterranean port of Sète. The wine flooded the avenue of Marcel Juan, the street in front of the wine merchant's premises, was several inches deep along the stretch of the road. Police did not comment on what caused the massive leak, but a local press was quick to speculate that it was a work of sabotagers, such as a Wine Action Committee, a group of wine terrorists bent on militant action to protect local produce from foreign imports. The group was previously went under the name CRAV and has been active since 1970 in France's biggest wine-growing region. The group has also been in recent years known to hijack tankers of foreign wine in dynamited government buildings or supermarkets. So this group, this is crazy. Apparently this is happening and it's serious. Now, in April of this past year, French winemakers, five of their tankers were hijacked. It was all filled with Spanish wine on the border being brought in. It was like the equivalent to 90,000 bottles of red and white, completely torn out and spilled everywhere. So this group is going around, or multiple groups, this is the big known one, and angry with what is being imported. Now, if we look at the wine industry in France, everybody thinks, well, everybody's drinking French wine in France. Well, no, they're actually one of the biggest buyers of Spanish wine. They brought in 400 million hectoliters in that region alone in southern France. This is up from 10%, and every year it's increasing because it is so cheap.
Yeah.
If you've ever been to a wine store, you know for the majority, your French bottles are going to be on the higher end of what you're looking for. And that's such a great appeal with Spanish wines. And that's why it's had such a firestorm here in the United States. Spanish red wine, it was so hot 2 years ago. And you couldn't keep it on the shelf.
Well, it's not half bad and it's cheap.
Oh, it's fantastic. It's great.
It's better than the crap that comes out of California.
You're getting a lot of the flavor profiles that you do in these French wines where it's all old vine. So it's that old school mentality of winemaking and these really, really earthy flavors. Whereas, you know, in here, not to knock California wine, but it's a lot of still fermented. It's lighter. And there's some.
I'll knock California wine all day and all night. It's garbage. Unless you're paying an arm and a leg for something that was actually made the right way, mm-hmm. What passes for wine in this country is a travesty.
No, and don't get me wrong. There are some amazing, amazing vineyards and wineries in Napa, Sonoma County.
Yeah, but there's also a lot of third-rate swill coming out of there.
Mm-hmm. But it's worth $3 a bottle. But I come from, old school of, again, old vines.
Yeah.
But this is crazy that this is happening, and the market has created these, as they call them, terrorist groups that are, spoiling stores.
There's a lot of people in the European countryside with a lot of time on their hands, yeah, and access and surprisingly easy access to explosives.
Well, it's so funny because when you sometimes bring up a story about French cheese and how important it is, or the olive oil in Italy,
yeah,
and all the stories that surround this, I mean, for the majority, it's coming out of Europe, where these products are so near and dear to the hearts of, the nationalists in that country. So they take it seriously.
But the other side of it is that there's some town with like 500 people in it, and like one of the guys in town knows where there's like a dump of old plastic explosive. Mm-hmm. So that we can just go get that and some grenades and landmines and go blow some stuff up. I mean, this happens. Mm-hmm. It is almost impossible to believe that this happens in the 21st century. But yeah, those guys are still out there. They're still hanging out in these little out-of-the-way villages in Europe, and they're ready to blow some stuff up and make some trouble. Wine terrorists. Hmm. My definition of wine terrorists is,
it's actually what I call myself after.
Yeah, no.
Couple bottles.
That's the bachelorette party at the restaurant downtown. Those are the wine terrorists right there. Yep. Get a little wine in them and run as far as you can. In technology news, our next flight to the moon will be conducted by a private company. Moon Express has become the first company in history to win permission from the United States government to fly to the moon after winning approval from a raft of federal agencies, including the Federal Aviation Administration, the State Department, NASA, and the Federal Communications Commission. Moon Express plans to launch a small lunar lander next year that will contain science experiments, high-definition cameras, and cremated human remains. The approval process was seen as a crucial step toward allowing more private companies the opportunity to operate beyond Earth's stratosphere. So that's been the rule up until now. You want to send up, you want to do suborbital stuff? Great, have fun. You want to throw satellites up there? Great, have fun. Yeah, once you're out of the stratosphere, no, you can't do that, because that is protected by international treaties. So this company in April filed partly because Google is offering $30 million for the first company that can get a rover on the moon and move it about 1,800 yards. So these guys are going for the $30 million Google prize, and they filed their application. Everybody in Washington sat around and said, can we do this? Is this legal? And they all looked at it, and they all talked about it, and they all asked the right questions, and they said, yes, we can do this. And they have given Moon Express permission to go forward. There are now going to be dozens of companies lining up, including Elon Musk's SpaceX, for opportunities, because it's well known that Elon Musk wants to put a rover on Mars.
I was going to say, I believe that he's going to be in the forefront of all of this.
Yeah, he wants to go to Mars, and he will probably achieve that. But there are a lot of companies that want to drill asteroids. They want to see what's under the surface of the moon. They want to explore intermediate areas of space. It's a big moment. This is the moment when we start entering the Stanley Kubrick 2001 Star Trek future, when you have all of these companies that are now involved in space travel and space flight and space commerce. And we will be talking about space commerce and realizing products from space commerce probably within the next 10 to 15 years.
Yeah, we've been, and for years, been hearing, you know, about traveling through space, traveling to the moon. And now that's somewhat of a reality.
Yeah.
Now, I propose a question to you. Would you go into space? Given the opportunity.
Yeah, I'd go into space.
With the physical demands and everything, you would go through the whole training thing just to be able to do that.
No, I want to just get on a thing and go.
Oh, no. I'm talking about reality and what you actually have
reality,
to do.
Reality is that most people can just get on a thing and go.
And it's not that simple.
Yeah, it is that simple.
No, not quite.
No, it absolutely is that simple.
It's a little taxing on the body and what you have to change, your diet.
Liftoff is a little taxing on the body.
I'm talking about currently, right now. I'm not talking about in 5-10 years when whatever company does whatever to achieve these goals of having a universal system to travel
to
space.
We have roller coasters.
You yourself right now can't get on how you are, like, and just get on.
Sure I can.
You would be fine. You wouldn't get sick, nothing.
I wouldn't get any sicker than anybody else in my kind of shape getting on that. We have roller coasters now that pull close to the same amount of G's as a rocket.
Yes.
They don't do it for the same duration.
That's what I'm saying.
You're just pulling those G's.
I'm talking about that for what?
For a moment.
25 seconds.
And we don't know. Yeah, because that's a rough ride until you get out of the atmosphere. But the more that they research it and the more people that they send up there, the more that it seems, yeah, you could take everyday people and put them into space. There would probably be some consideration as to whether or not you have motion sickness or altitude sickness.
That's what I'm, yeah.
You would need to screen people for that. I can get a little more.
I mean, you're making it sound like you get in a car and it's just like, yeah, we're going to drive.
Well, you don't want to be in space vomiting constantly because that's not fun.
Yeah.
You know, it's like.
And that's what I'm saying. You physically right now cannot get on.
I don't know that I might be able to. I don't know. I know that in terms of altitude.
I just feel like you need to condition your body before putting yourself through that.
I know that in terms of altitude sickness, it's not a problem. I mean, it's not like you're going to be up there for a week.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to be up there for like a month. People who are going to be up there and trying to work in that environment need to be in exceptionally good physical shape because it is very
duration of time.
It is very difficult to move, first of all. It is even more difficult to move when you get one of those space suits on. And it does tax the human body to be up there for any duration. But for a couple of hours, they've been talking about doing suborbital flights with passengers for years now. Elon Musk is going to make that happen. Where, like, you can go up there and you're going to be on the edge of space and you're going to be floating around and having a good time. And it's the idea is that anybody should be able to do that. We'll find out whether or not. I think what's going to happen is you're going to start doing that and you're going to find out that, 40% of the population just throws up the entire time. So you got to screen it out. You got to screen it out some way, or you got to have the cabin for people who throw up and the cabin for people who don't.
And that's what I'm saying. Not many people would be able to handle it.
I don't know about that. That's a reasonable question to ask. And I don't know that we know the absolute answer to that question.
I just want to let you know I have the first update of our Olympic adventure.
Oh, boy.
Women's U.S. soccer beat, who is it? They beat New Zealand 2-0.
Did anyone show up for the game?
Probably not.
Yeah, nobody was really there for the women's soccer game earlier today.
Nope.
No one. There's no sun up in the sky. Stormy weather.
WMFO Medford, your Boston 5-day forecast. You got another good night for sleeping tonight. Mostly clear skies. Temperatures fall back into the 50s. In the cooler suburbs, around about 60 degrees downtown. Open the window, turn off the AC. Enjoy that refreshing air. Tomorrow, we're going to kick up the humidity a little bit. But it's not going to be too terribly hot or too terribly humid. Sunny skies, high of about 80. We fall back into the mid-60s tomorrow night. Friday, a little bit warmer, more of the same. Temperature in the mid-80s, only falling back to about 70 on Friday night downtown. So keep the air conditioner handy. As you might expect, when you get that kind of heat and humidity, thunderstorms are a possibility Friday afternoon. Saturday, good chance that we're going to see some thunderstorms. Take advantage of it because that may be the last rain that we see for about 2 weeks. So scattered thunderstorms, 60% chance of rain on Saturday. That's going to be late in the afternoon. Before that, partly cloudy skies, highs in the mid-80s. Temperatures fall back to about 70 on Saturday night. And then on Sunday, less humid, a little bit cooler, mostly sunny. High around 82, lows in the mid-60s. On Sunday night. So
sounds like a perfect day for a concert.
If you're going to the Pearl Jam, Sunday night's going to be good. If you're looking to do some yard work, Sunday is going to be good. If you're looking to get some rain in the yard, pray that we get something on Saturday because Lord knows we need those soaking rains around here. When we come back, did you hear all of the other stories that Lisa and I found interesting and that are making news right here on WMFO Medford?
Sirloin is a popular family steak. All sirloins are excellent eating, but there are some slight differences. To get the most lean meat for your money, look for a sirloin steak with a round bone. To get the most tender sirloin, look for one with a long, flat bone. You can broil or pan broil sirloin steak if it's graded USDA Prime, Choice, or Good. If you want more tips on buying steak, write How to Buy Meat, Agriculture Radio, Washington, D.C., 20250.
This is the sound of salmonella gyrating on your undercooked chicken. And it looks like mom might be taking it out a little early. Don't let salmonella get funky with your chicken. On average, 1 in 6 Americans will get a foodborne illness this year. So use a thermometer to cook each type of meat to the right temperature. Keep your family safe at foodsafety.gov. Brought to you by the USDA, HHS, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to The Big Picture on WMFO 91.5 Medford. He's Derek Arian. I'm Lisa Nichols here with you every Wednesday night. And as always, we want you to be a part of the show. The way that you do that, you give us a call at 855-915-WMFO. That's 855-915-9636. And I do have to say, Derek, you said the number correctly in the beginning of the show, and you took off a Pokemon song. Finally. Thank you.
Oh, Pokemon song will be back after the Olympics. Don't worry about that.
Well, of course, it's time for, did you hear, the part of the show where Derek and I quiz each other by giving each other, you know, 1, 2, 3 words, and we have to tell what that meant in today's news, yesterday news, the last couple days. So we want to inform you about it and each other. And we're competitive and just want to prove each other's intellect. I will start. Hot air balloon.
16 people were killed in Texas when a hot air balloon attempting a landing collided with power wires early Saturday morning. It is the worst air balloon disaster in recorded U.S. history. And everybody's saying it's the worst air balloon disaster in U.S. history. I got to believe that back in the early days, before we had newspapers and people actually used these things for travel, that there were probably some pretty bad hot air balloon disasters. Mm-hmm. But this is the worst one in recorded U.S. history. And the guy who was flying this thing, a bit of a character, his name is Alfred Nichols.
Yeah, no relation.
Are we sure of this?
Nope.
Alfred Nichols. Lisa Nichols.
Alfred Skip Nichols? Definitely no.
You seem like someone who'd have a skip in your family. You're sure there's Alfred Nichols is not? So Alfred He's Nichols, four DUIs. Arrest for distributing a controlled substance. And so many complaints from the Better Business Bureau that people in St. Louis were told not to do business with him.
Mm. Here's a fun thing. Now, Nichols did not have to tell the FAA about any of these problems, the multiple, you know, convictions, the DUI charges, because of this oversight for hot air balloon pilots. It's very different from if you're a pilot of a helicopter or a plane. You know, they're expected to self-report. Apparently, Skip did not feel like he needed to do that. He owned, it was called Heart of Texas Hot Air Balloons. And again, as Derek said, 16 people died, including himself. Tragic.
Yeah.
Very, very tragic.
Apparently, there was thick fog when he was trying to land. It was early in the day. The guy's past history may or may not play a role here. You know, we hear about power balloons, hot air balloons, and power lines all the time. If there is a balloon accident, it is a pretty fair bet that there are power lines involved in this somehow.
No, and absolutely. I mean, as they said, they don't believe at the time there was any alcohol involved. But it's the same conversation that we've had before with, you know, when the accident happened with the duck boat.
Yeah.
And saying a driver shouldn't have, well, I maintain the stance that a driver who has 11 speeding tickets within a short period of time should not be driving. And you said everybody gets 100 speeding tickets, which many people that I have actually talked to have not. But the thing about that is you have to picture.
Had nothing to do with that accident,
but,
by
but
the
listen,
way.
Listen, I know it didn't. But what I'm trying to say is if you had a sign before you entered the hot air balloon, or you entered and said, hi, my name is Skip, and I have 4 DUI convictions. Do you still want to get on this with me? You have to think about it in that mentality. Not in a literal sense where they have a sign up, but would you feel comfortable putting your son or daughter, your husband or wife, on a hot air balloon knowing that? The same thing. Would you feel safe putting your child or your significant other on a duck boat knowing that the driver had, regardless of...